Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Today, I report about the American Medical Association's recent statement on guns. Then, Susan Shand tells about a new, yet ancient, activity for tourists in parts of the United States. We also hear a short piece of What It Takes, a podcast series from the American Academy of Achievement. And as always, we close the show with an American story. Today, we listen to part two of The Blue Hotel by Stephen Crane. The American Medical Association, or AMA, has called for a ban on military-style firearms and expressed opposition to arming schoolteachers. The group made this statement at its yearly policymaking meeting. It called gun violence in the United States a public health crisis. The AMA is the largest group of doctors and medical students in the United States. Dr. Megan Ranney is an emergency medicine specialist at Brown University. She said at the gathering, "We as physicians are the witnesses to the human toll of this disease." AMA delegates voted to approve several gun-related proposals presented by doctors' groups that are part of the AMA's membership. They agreed to support any bans on the purchase or possession of guns and ammunition by people under 21 years of age, support laws that would require documented permission and safety classes for gun owners, and registration of all firearms. Press for legislation that would permit relatives of suicidal people or those who have threatened violence to seek court-ordered removal of guns from the home. Support better training for physicians in how to recognize patients at risk for suicide. Push for more restrictive laws on the purchase or possession of guns by people found guilty of violence, including expanding such measures to cover stalkers. There are gun owners and supporters among AMA members. A doctor from Montana told delegates about learning to shoot as part of the education program at her middle school. But a large majority of members supported banning military-style firearms. The group approved the measure with 446 votes in favor, 99 against. "There's a place to start, and this should be it," said Dr. Jim Hinsdale just before the vote. He is a trauma surgeon in San Jose, California. Gun violence is not a new issue for the AMA. It has supported past efforts to ban military-style firearms and declared gun violence a public health crisis. AMA President David Barb described as extraordinary the number of related measures on this year's agenda. He said that recent violence, including the Florida school shooting and the Las Vegas attack, created, in his words, a new sense of urgency while Congress fails to act. Dr. Barb, who was speaking on his final day as AMA president, said, "The most important audience for our message right now is our legislators. And second most important is the public, because sometimes it requires public pressure on the legislators." The 243,000-member AMA has more influence with politicians and the public than other doctor groups. The National Rifle Association did not immediately answer email and telephone requests for comment about the doctors' votes. AMA members pointed to U.S. government data that show about 40,000 people died and 111,000 were injured from guns in 2016. Cases of each have been rising in recent years.
Falconry is an old tradition in many parts of the world, including Western Europe, the Middle East, and Central Asia. Now, it is becoming a tourist activity at hotels and other places in the United States, from Vermont to Colorado to California. The ancient sport of using birds of prey to hunt wild animals has existed for at least 4,000 years. Experiences designed for the tourism industry do not usually involve hunting. They center on the flight of the birds and their return to their human trainers. During a demonstration for visitors to the Woodstock Inn in Vermont, a professional falconer teaches about birds of prey and the history of falconry. He also flies a trained Harris's hawk. Then he helps interested observers fly the hawk themselves. Bouchaine Vineyards in California started using falconers in 2016 to stop birds from eating their crops. Vineyard visitors were pleased to see the hawks fly and work with their trainer. So the company decided to offer guests that experience as part of a wine tasting and lunch. It's amazing to showcase the birds and to be able to actually hold a glove out and have a falcon land on your hand, said employee Chris Kajani. He said the falconry program also gives the vineyard good publicity. At New England Falconry in Vermont recently, a young Harris's hawk named Audubon launched from a high place. He flew through the wind over a grassy field straight to falconer Jessica Snyder's hand. She then treated the one-year-old hawk to a piece of meat. "He has fun out here," she said. She also noted that the bird has about 10 times the sight ability of an average human. The Harris's hawk has brown feathers and yellow legs with long black talons. Its strong eyesight enables it to spot prey on the ground below. The Harris's hawk, which hunts in groups, is considered the most social bird of prey. However, each has its own personality, Snyder said. Falconers attach an electronic device to their birds so they can be found if they do not return from a flight. Growth in the use of hunting guns almost ended falconry, which arrived in the U.S. in the early 1900s. Sheldon Nicole, president of the North American Falconers Association, said it is generally an activity of wealthy people. But, Nicole said, there are now 20 or 30 places to enjoy falconry experiences in the U.S. I'm Susan Shand.
I come from a real working-class acting family. It's not a glamorous life. My stepfather, who I grew up with, was a stuntman slash actor, but basically a stuntman. My mother, interesting, would one week go to work on Bonanza and then not work for a few weeks and then get a job on Perry Mason and then not work for a while and then get another job on another television series. So it was really the typical dangerous working class actor's life in that you never knew if you were going to have an income. It's a very difficult life. It's so incredibly insecure. And when I grew up, twice we had all our things in our house repossessed. And it was extremely influential to me to live in a house one day and then not the next.
You can find the whole podcast about Sally Field on our website, learningenglish.voanews.com.
The Blue Hotel, Part 2.
I think you are tongue-tied,
says Scully, finally to his son, the cowboy, and the Easterner. And at the end of this sentence, he left the room. Upstairs, the Swede was closing his bag. His back was half-turned towards the door. And hearing a noise there, he turned and jumped up, uttering a loud cry. Scully's face was frightening in the light of the small lamp he carried. This yellow shine, streaming upward, left his eyes in deep shadows. He looked like a murderer.
Man,
exclaimed Scully.
Have you gone mad? Oh, no,
answered the other.
There are people in this world who know nearly as much as you do, understand?
For a moment, they stood gazing at each other. Then Scully placed the light on the table and sat himself on the edge of the bed. He spoke slowly.
I never heard of such a thing in my life. It's a complete mystery. I can't think how you ever got this idea into your head.
Then Scully lifted his eyes and asked,
And did you really think they were going to kill you?
The Swede looked at the old man as if he wished to see into his mind.
I did,
he said at last. He apparently thought that this answer might cause an attack. As he worked on his bag, his whole arm shook, the elbow trembling like a bit of paper. Having finished with his bag, the Swede straightened himself.
Mr. Scully,
he said with sudden courage,
how much do I owe you?
You don't owe me anything,
said the old man angrily.
I won't take your money, not after what's been happening here.
Then a plan seemed to come to him.
Here!
He cried, picking up his lamp and moving towards the door.
Here, come with me a minute.
No,
said the Swede in great alarm.
Yes,
urged the old man.
Come on, I want you to come just across the hall, in my room.
The Swede must have decided that the hour of his death had come. His mouth dropped open, and his teeth showed like a dead man's. He at last followed Scully across the hall. But he had the step of one hung in chains.
"Now,"
said the old man. He dropped suddenly to the floor and put his head beneath the bed. The Swede could hear his dulled voice.
"I'd keep it under my pillow if it weren't for that boy Johnny. Where is it now? I never put it twice in the same place. There. Now, come out."
Finally, he came out from under the bed, dragging with him an old coat.
"I've got it,"
he whispered. Still on the floor on his knees, he unrolled the coat and took from it a large yellow-brown whiskey bottle. His first act was to hold the bottle up to the light. Satisfied, apparently, that nobody had touched it, he pushed it with a generous movement toward the Swede. The weak-kneed Swede was about to eagerly grasp this element of strength, but he suddenly pulled his hand away and cast a look of terror upon Scully.
"Drink,"
said the old man in a friendly tone. He had risen to his feet and now stood facing the Swede. There was a silence. Then again, Scully said,
"Drink."
The Swede laughed wildly.
"Ha ha ha!"
He seized the bottle, put it to mouth, and as his lips curled foolishly around the opening and his throat worked, he kept his glance, burning with hate, upon the old man's face. After the departure of Scully, the three men, still at the table, sat for a long moment in surprised silence. Then Johnny said,
"That's the worst man I ever saw."
"Oh, I don't know,"
replied the Easterner.
"Well, what do you think makes him act that way?"
asked the cowboy.
"He's frightened."
The Easterner knocked his pipe against the stove.
"He's frightened right out of his senses."
At what?
Asked Johnny and the cowboy together.
"I don't know, but it seems to me this man has been reading cheap novels about the West, and he thinks he's in the middle of it, the shooting and killing and all."
"But,"
said the cowboy, deeply shocked,
"this isn't a wild place. This is Nebraska."
"Yes,"
added Johnny.
"And why doesn't he wait until he really gets out west?"
The traveled Easterner laughed.
"Things aren't bad even there. Not in these days. But he thinks he's right in the middle of hell."
Johnny and the cowboy thought for a long while.
"It's strange,"
remarked Johnny at last.
"Yes,"
said the cowboy.
"This is a queer game. I hope we don't get a lot of snow, because then we'd have to have this man with us all the time. That wouldn't be any good."
Soon they heard a loud noise on the stairs, accompanied by jokes in the voice of old Scully, and laughter, evidently, from the Swede. The men around the stove stared in surprise at each other. The door swung open, and Scully and the Swede came into the room. Five chairs were now placed in a circle about the stove. The Swede began to talk, loudly and angrily. Johnny, the cowboy, and the Easterner remained silent while old Scully appeared to be eager and full of sympathy. Finally, the Swede announced that he wanted a drink of water. He moved in his chair and said that he would go and get some.
"I'll get it for you,"
said Scully at once.
"No,"
refused the Swede roughly.
"I'll get it for myself."
He got up and walked with the manner of an owner into another part of the hotel. As soon as the Swede was out of the room, Scully jumped to his feet and whispered quickly to the others.
"Upstairs, he thought I was trying to poison him."
"This makes me sick,"
said Johnny.
"Why don't you throw him out in the snow?"
"He's all right now,"
declared Scully.
"He was from the East, and he thought this was a rough place. That's all. He's all right now.
The cowboy looked with admiration upon the Easterner.
You were right,
he said.
Well,
said Johnny to his father.
He may be all right now, but I don't understand it. Before, he was afraid, but now he's too brave.
Scully now spoke to his son.
What do I keep? What do I keep? What do I keep?
He demanded in a voice like thunder. He struck his knees sharply to indicate he himself was going to make reply, and that all should listen.
I keep a hotel,
he shouted.
A hotel, do you hear? A guest under my roof has special privileges. He is not to be threatened. Not one word shall he hear that would make him want to go away. There's no place in this town where they can say they took in a guest of mine because he was afraid to stay here.
He turned suddenly upon the cowboy and the Easterner.
Am I right?
Yes, Mr. Scully,
said the cowboy.
I think you're right.
Yes, Mr. Scully,
said the Easterner.
I think you're right.
At supper that evening, the Swede burned with energy. He sometimes seemed on the point of bursting into loud song, and in all of his madness, he was encouraged by old Scully. The Easterner was quiet. The cowboy sat in wide-mouthed wonder, forgetting to eat, while Johnny angrily finished great plates of food. The daughters of the house, when they were obliged to bring more bread, approached as carefully as rabbits. Having succeeded in their purpose, they hurried away with poorly hidden fear. The Swede controlled the whole feast, and he gave it the appearance of a cruel affair. He seemed to have grown suddenly taller. He gazed bitterly into every face. His voice rang through the room. After supper, as the men went toward the other room, the Swede hit Scully hard on the shoulder.
Well, old boy, that was a good meal.
Johnny looked hopefully at his father. He knew that the old man's shoulder was still painful from an old hurt. And indeed, it appeared for a moment as if Scully were going to flame out in anger about it. But Scully only smiled a sickly smile and remained silent. The others understood that he was admitting his responsibility for the Swede's new attitude. When they were gathered about the stove, the Swede insisted on another game of cards. In his voice, there was always a great threat. The cowboy and the Easterner both agreed without interest to play. Scully said that he would soon have to go to meet the evening train, and so the Swede turned to Johnny. For a moment, their glances crossed like swords, and then Johnny smiled and said,
Yes, I'll play.
They formed a square around the table. The Easterner and the Swede again played together. As the game continued, it was noticeable that the cowboy was not playing as noisily as before. Scully left to meet the train. In spite of his care, an icy wind blew into the room as he opened the door. It scattered the cards and froze the players. The Swede cursed frightfully. When Scully returned, his icy entrance interrupted a comfortable and friendly scene. The Swede cursed again, but soon they were once more giving attention to their game, their heads bent forward and their hands moving fast. Scully took up a newspaper, and as he slowly turned from page to page, it made a comfortable sound. Then suddenly he heard three awful words.
You are cheating.
The little room was now filled with terror. After the three words, The first sound in the room was made by Scully's paper as it fell forgotten to his feet. His eyeglasses had fallen from his nose, but by a grasp, he had caught them. He stared at the card players. Probably the silence was only an instant long. Then, if the floor had been suddenly pulled out from under the men, they could not have moved more quickly. The five had thrown themselves at a single point. Johnny, as he rose to throw himself upon the Swede, almost fell. The loss of the moment allowed time for the arrival of Scully. It also gave the cowboy time to give the Swede a good push, which sent him backwards. The men found voices together, and shouts of anger, appeal, or fear burst from every throat. The cowboy pushed and pulled feverishly at the Swede, and the Easterner and Scully held wildly to Johnny. But through the smoky air, above the straining bodies of the peace compellers, the eyes of the enemies steadily warned each other. Scully's voice was loudest.
Stop now! Stop, I say! Stop now!
Johnny, as he struggled to break away from Scully and the Easterner, was crying.
Well, he says I cheated. He says I cheated. I won't allow any man to say I cheated. If he says I cheated him, he's a...
The cowboy was telling the Swede.
Stop now, do you hear?
The screams of the Swede never ceased.
He did cheat. I saw him. I saw him.
As for the Easterner, he was begging in a voice that was not heard.
Wait a moment, can't you? Oh, wait a moment. What's the use of fighting over a game of cards? Wait a moment.
In this noisy quarrel, no complete sentence was clear.
Cheat.
Stop.
He says...
These pieces cut the screaming and rang out sharply. It was remarkable that Scully, who undoubtedly made the most noise, was the least heard. Then suddenly there was a great stillness. It was as if each man had paused for breath. Although the room still filled with the anger of men, it could be seen there was no danger of immediate fighting. At once, Johnny pushed forward.
Why did you say I cheated? Why did you say I cheated? I don't cheat, and I won't let any man say I do.
The Swede said,
I saw you! I saw you!
Well,
cried Johnny,
I'll fight any man who says I cheat.
No, you won't,
said the cowboy.
Not here.
Johnny spoke to the Swede again.
Did you say I cheated?
The Swede showed his teeth.
Yes.
Then,
said Johnny,
we must fight.
Yes, fight!
Roared the Swede. He was like a mad devil.
Yes, fight! I'll show you what kind of a man I am. I'll show you who you want to fight. Maybe you think I can't fight. Maybe you think I can't. I'll show you, you criminal. Yes, you cheated. You cheated. You cheated.
Well, let's start then, fella,
said Johnny coolly. The cowboy turned in despair to Scully.
What are you going to do now?
A change had come over the old man. He now seemed all eagerness. His eyes glowed.
We'll let them fight,
he answered bravely.
I can't watch this any longer. I've endured this cursed Swede till I'm sick. We'll let them fight.
And that is our show today. For VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver. Thanks for listening.